question which I have posed for this morning. Can the media be trusted? Can be very simply answered. The answer is no. But then if I were to pose the question, can an encyclopedia be trusted? The answer would also be no. Some years ago, when they were beginning the process of putting together the first major encyclopedia of Judaica, Jewish studies, to be done in English in the post-war period, I was asked, among other things, to write the article on heresy. I don't know if they knew their natural customer, but I had written a long history on the Maimonidean controversy, and I think they felt that I had done some work in this area. I tried to define heresy in that article as simply those men and women of deep and convinced opinion who simply do not have the power or the votes to control the central apparatus of a religious institution. And the senior editor of the encyclopedia was delighted with the piece. Encyclopedia Judaica was published in English, but in Israel. An Israeli publisher hired a number of yeshiva students to do the final proofreading. And when my article appeared in Galleys, heresy had been redefined as deviations from accepted Jewish truth. Now, yeshiva bochers are not the only ones who cause encyclopedias to be less than fully trustworthy. Everyone who writes anything has an agenda. He wants to convince you of something. There's a selection of facts. Or he or she simply shares the prejudices and preconceptions and conventional wisdom of a particular time, culture, or place. Someday when you feel compelled to do so, take the Encyclopedia Britannica and look up the article on Poland. It runs to about 30 pages. The article, though it's written by Westerners, reflects all the traditional attitudes of Polish people about Jews. There were 3.5 million Jews in Poland just before the Second World War. Jews had lived in Poland for nearly 1,000 years. They represented 10% of the population. They had made major contributions to all areas of Polish life, and of course have had a very active and creative religious culture of their own. But you look through these 30 pages on Poland and find hardly a word about the Jews. It's as if they did not exist. As a matter of fact, when you come to the one real mention of the Jews, it has to do with Auschwitz, and there it's almost by way of an afterthought. This is the exact quotation. Auschwitz became especially notorious for the systematic murder of its inmates, period. Unknown numbers of Poles perished there, and it became a grave for a great part of the 3 million Polish Jews. Now, the bulk of the people who died at Auschwitz were Jews. And there's no mention in this article about the Warsaw Ghetto and the battle it had fought for so many months against the Wehrmacht. There's no mention of Jewish participation in the Polish underground. There's no mention of Polish pogroms against the Jews during and after the Second World War. Only this mention of 3.5 millions of people who had lived in this country for well over 1,000 years. The Poles considered them as strangers, aliens in their midst, and those who wrote about Poland continued that prejudice. Now, anyone who's trained to be an historian is trained to be suspicious of documents. Some documents are forgeries. Some documents are deliberate attempts to disinform, put across a definite point of view. They're part of the propaganda apparatus of a particular group. You may recall that at the beginning of the Second World War, there was a great hue and cry in the Allied nations that efforts must be exerted in order to save as many of those who were condemned to death by the Germans as could possibly be saved. And the Allies responded to this outcry by holding two conferences on refugees, one at Bermuda and one at Evian. And one had the sense, if one had read the communiques which came out of these two meetings of the heads of states of the major allies, that a great effort would be undertaken to save those who could be saved from the fires. But in point of fact, as research has shown in the archives of England, the United States, France, that was not the intention of these two conferences. The intention was to issue these communiques, to silence the outcry, to head off any demand that the Allies open their doors and admit refugees, Jews and others, who otherwise would be barred from entrance, those who might be saved. There's propaganda, there's disinformation, and there is the instinctive presuppositions which any writer, any auditor, any viewer brings to what he sees and hears and thinks he knows about. We can only ask the questions that we are prepared to ask. We will see a situation in the terms in which we are prepared to see it. Someday, if you're interested, read the correspondence, the articles which were sent home by missionaries who went out to the what we now call the Third World in the 18th and 19th centuries. And what you'll find is that the cultures where they work are painted as backward, as pagan, colorful, but not, there's no understanding of the strengths which are inherent in the culture given its time and its place. They're bringing the light, and therefore those who are they are describing must somehow be dark and in the shadows. I've been struck, because it's very much in the news, by the way in which most of the media is covering the events in the Union of South Africa. They're painting it as a morality play between the forces of darkness and the forces of light, of good and of evil. And they're doing so in largest measure because the United States has, in the last 30 years or so, finally gone through a major change in our racial outlook, where we have outlawed apartheid in the South and enforced rules of economic opportunity and of the like in the North. This is, we have far from removed the stain of racism for our society, but we've been able to achieve a great deal without paralyzing the economy, without having a revolution which would destroy the basis, the constitutional basis of our government. And so we bring to the view of the reporting on South Africa the same kind of assumptions which have governed us here. And racism is evil, and repression is evil, and apartheid is evil. But because we tend to have the events of South Africa reported to us only in terms of blacks and of whites, only in terms of evil and of good, therefore we tend to assume that the only way to deal effectively, to be constructive in our response to this, is to impose a total embargo on all the sale of goods and services and technology and the like, to prohibit investment in that country. Now, in point of fact, we ought to be bestirring ourselves to do all that we can to encourage human rights in South Africa. That's our responsibility as human beings. But South Africa is more than blacks crying out for freedom and whites determined to suppress their demands for freedom. It's a very complex society. It's a society where there's a degree of freedom of expression, where there are whites who do care and who are among the African National Congress people and other groups who would like to establish change. I read a lot. And one of the things I tend to read are temple bulletins. Rabbi Lelieveld, as you know, has been spending this spring 6 months as on leave to one of the congregations in Johannesburg. In the most recent bulletin from his congregation, he wrote of South Africa in this way. We find ourselves living in an incredibly complex society. There are no easy generalizations adequate to describe it. There is so much to learn and so many preconceptions that need correction. For one thing, there is much more freedom of expression than we had anticipated. The police action against United Democratic Front leadership, which as of this writing occurred just yesterday, has occasioned a storm of protest, which the English language press faithfully reports and against which it is editorialized. Segregation of public facilities is breaking down, at least here in Johannesburg. And it goes on, speaking of attending some mass rallies for Bishop Tutu and for the Roman Catholic Archbishop Hurley, who is being tried for various seditious crimes, attending a play called Rise Up, Albert Luthuli, which is a protest play against racism and apartheid. And he says, goes on and concludes, the voices of opponents of apartheid and advocates of social reform are heard daily here in Johannesburg. The question of the effect of anti-apartheid protest abroad, and especially disinvestment, as it is called here, is a subject of some debate, and its results are still uncertain. All I am saying is that if the reporting is done, that we read, is done only in terms of black and white, of the moral issues, given the fact that politics is the art of the possible, we may, in fact, by plunging ahead in our determination to do the right, to be on the side of God and the good, be precluding some kinds of effective strengthenings of effective groups in the Union of South Africa, which may in fact hasten the coming of the day for which everyone works and prays, whereas a bolder, more dramatic, less intelligently conceived program may in fact delay it. I don't know the answer, but I do know that unless one gets behind the reporting that 18 people have been killed in the riot, behind the images of riot police attacking unarmed blacks, unless one gets to some understanding of the inner dynamics and mechanisms of the society, one would not be able to devise for America as intelligent citizens that combination of the carrot and the stick, which is obviously ought to be in one way or another basic to our approach and to our policies. Now, the problems that the media face are not simply the problems of the inevitable distortions which appear in the press, distortions which come around because of the deliberate misuse of the press, distortions which come about because of the inevitable limitations of human wisdom. There is no such thing as pure objectivity. Only God can be purely objective and thoroughly knowledgeable about human life. But the press also operates in a world which recognizes its power, its importance. After all, the media determine what we know to a very large degree. They raise up the issues which have priority among us. The issues which do not reach the public press pass almost unknown. And yet they operate in a world where the institutions of the society are eager to intrude into the channels of communication, the point of view which they espouse, information which is useful to the purposes of that institution or that corporation or that union or that government bureau. And with the best will in the world, the press cannot possibly check out every bit of information which is fed to it by the public relation mills of the United States. I read someplace that the Defense Department alone has a larger budget for public relations than the entire news budgets of CBS, NBC, ABC, CNN, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Wall Street Journal. Now, that's only one government department, albeit the largest. And it's been estimated that there are something on the order of 100 public relations professionals out there eager to feed things into the media, either to give shape to the news, either eager to keep the media off from looking under rocks that they ought not to look under, for everyone who is a reporter, a professional within the media itself. For one of the truisms, which is in fact not true, is that we have a free press in the United States. In point of fact, every news bureau, radio, press, television, is part of a profit-making organization. It survives because someone can pay the salary of the reporters, can pay the travel budgets, can pay for the equipment which they require. News media, news bureaus are expensive, and they must make a profit. These corporations are not in the business of dispensing the news for our benefit, purely. And so it is that there are limitations to what they can do, to the number of people who can be hired, the number of stories that can be researched. And inevitably, I find myself most at war, unhappy with the media, when I watch 100 reporters chasing after a presidential candidate for months on end. What news can be garnered from this kind of waste of professionals in the news-gathering field? Nothing the candidate says is really worth quoting. Certainly, one reporter is enough to tell us the color of the dress that Nancy Reagan or Joan Mondale wore that day, or the fact that the president could not remember the name of the congressman who introduced him. That's not news. And I keep wondering why it is that 200 and some odd news people have to fill a room in the White House for a presidential news conference. 250 highly trained, highly intelligent professionals who could be busy doing other things, who could easily have given to one or two of their midst a list of the questions that everybody wants asked. We know exactly the questions that are going to be asked. I could write them out before any news conference, deal with the news of the day. And one could have a young person in the newsroom tape down the televised conference so that the editors could look at it and decide what they wanted to use as news and what they didn't. And the other 240 competent people could be out there looking under the rocks, pursuing stories, instead of all crowded into this room, wasting their time to hear the president, whoever it is, give them exactly the language that the president had been told to give them by his aides and advisors, and which one could pretty well have predicted before the conference itself. The news media does not use the limited resources, the very limited resources it has, very intelligently. And for that, I think it is to be severely faulted. It's so much easier to follow the herd. You're afraid that the president may drop a line, which you somehow won't pick up. But you, even if the president does drop a line, and every president does, within 6 hours, the president's press secretary will have come out with a statement as to what the president really meant, and that whole scoop will have been absolutely pointless. The media is an absolute necessity in a free society. Without our eyes and without these ears, their eyes, without these ears, we would not know a great deal about the complex world in which we live that we, in fact, need to know. But at the same time, we have to know that what the media sees and reports is only part of the reality, what it is prepared to see, what it is willing to report, what editors have determined is a story which is gettable and doable, which should not necessarily offend the advertisers or others in power. Because again, we go back to the simple truth that the media, news media, are in the business of helping their corporations make money. And that means that the media must have an audience. Because the way that the media make money is by having advertising. And when one looks at the equation in that shape, the problem with the news media is us. We don't want news. We want entertainment. We want excitement. We want human interest. The media have discovered this long since. No one will read, or few will read, a long two-page article explaining in depth one problem or another, giving us the facts, giving us background, giving us different points of view, providing the history of a particular issue. People, if they want news, want it in capsule form. They want it to be entertained. Why do people read the paper in the United States? For the sports, for the amusements, for the fashions, for the coupons for the supermarket, and for the want ads. That's what sells the newspaper. And what do they watch on television? Television must compete with entertainment and with sports. And to do so, television news must be entertaining, emotion-filled. Why were two CBS television people killed in Lebanon on Thursday? They were killed because they were told to provide 30 seconds or a minute of background emotion for the evening news. There was no news in southern Lebanon. Nothing new. The Israelis tell the reporters in Tel Aviv what villages they have entered, the methods that they're using to try and protect themselves until they remove themselves from the Lebanon are well known. They search homes, they blow up homes where there have been armed caches, and they take the arms and any terrorists that they find, and they take them back into their own territory. But a smoking gun, or the dust settling over the debris of a Shiite village home, a wailing woman bewailing her home, or someone who's been taken off, this is emotion. This is excitement. This appeals. And so two men lost their lives because Israelis at 800 yards mistook the man holding a television camera for a man holding a mortar, and they were shot. They were shot for no purpose, because what they were after was not news. The news which is available, which ought to be coming out of the Lebanon, is the question of why the Shiites, who welcomed the Israelis 3 years ago with flags, and open arms, why they have suddenly turned, become so violent, and have entered this begun this campaign of murder and intimidation. And I'll try next week to answer that question for you. But that's the issue that should be searched out. That's the report which should be given. But no one is very interested in the personality of Mr. Beiri, the head of the Amal. No one is able to trace or willing to trace the path which lies between Iran and the Hezbollah. Most of those who are sent to the Lebanon could not follow the story if they knew where to begin or even were told to follow it. Because one of the truths of the reporting profession is that few Western correspondents who are sent out of Europe to cover assignments speak the language of the country in which they find themselves. They're totally at the mercy of interpreters. They do not understand the culture, the way of the land. And so what they can do is quite limited. And since the real stories there are difficult to arrive at and to uncover, and since the whole process is an unfamiliar one, you're not operating in your home territory, what we see and receive is the surface of news, that which entertains, that which is shocking, that which is visual and dramatic, rather than the substance of the news which would allow an intelligent citizenry to come to some understanding of the issues. Now, for a long, long time, probably since the dawn of history, people have mistrusted the media. The first media were the heralds, the town criers, if you will. And they were, for the most part, hired by the palace or by the town council to cry out to the community the rules, the regulations, the news which they wanted the community to know. In ancient Israel, there was an official by the name of Mazkir. And this, he was a royal official, he belonged to the palace, and among his other duties was a duty of calling out in the streets of Jerusalem the rules and the orders which the palace was issuing for that particular day. The media are always under the control of authority when authority is able to assert its control over the media. This is the way you control a population. This is the way you determine what it will know, and therefore, to a large degree, what it will do. Well over 2/3 of all the media outlets in our world are owned by, manned by, or severely licensed and controlled by the state. They're not free in the sense of being able to go out after their own stories and report what they see to the best of their ability. Media are a very fragile institution. The first newspaper that was published in the United States was called Public Occurrences, Foreign and Domestic. It appeared on the 25th of September, 1690 in Boston. It was edited by a man named Benjamin Harris. It had one edition on the 25th of September, and it was never printed again. The next day, the press was closed down by the governor of Massachusetts Colony and by the Colonial Council. The framers of the Constitution knew what they were about when they wrote into the First Amendment that the Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of the press. They knew that if a free society requires as much real information about the problems that face it, the events of the day, as it can possibly garner in order to make intelligent decisions. Thomas Jefferson, who spoke vehemently in favor of the First Amendment, wrote in its defense, "The basis of our government being the opinion of the people, the very first object should be to keep that right. Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate for a moment to prefer the latter." 18 years later, when Thomas Jefferson was president of the United States, he wrote to the then governor of Pennsylvania complaining about the lies and licentiousness of the Federalist press, quote, "I have long thought that a few prosecutions and those prominent offenders would have a wholesome effort in restoring the integrity of the press." The integrity of the press as defined by those in power is always support for their particular policies and programs. And even a man of such high principle as Thomas Jefferson was not about feeling about the press as Richard Nixon, Jimmy Carter, and Ronald Reagan have felt about them. The integrity of the press has been translated in our day into a demand for objectivity. And this demand is spoken most of all by some in the White House and by people like Senator Jesse Helms, who complain that the press is too liberal, that it distorts the conservative point of view, that doesn't give the American people a balanced view of the social order, that opinion ought to be left to the editorial page and that the news ought to be presented just as news, just as fact. I assure you that if Jesse Helms were able to secure control of CBS and to secure editorial control, there would be as much conscious and unconscious slant in the news as there may be now. It simply would be coming from a point of view which would be more sympathetic to his own rather peculiar political opinions. Objectivity is impossible, total objectivity. What we can ask of the press is simply that they do the best job possible. And we ought to remember that there is no such thing as the public's right to know. We have in the United States the press's freedom to operate. But that's quite a different thing. We are not to pass laws which abridge the freedom of the press to search out those stories that they are able to, or willing or eager to discover and to print or to put them before the camera. But we are not guaranteed in this country the right to know simply by asking a question. And we require the instrumentality of the press in order to know whatever we can know. Someone has to do the research. Someone has to lift up the facts. Someone has to present them to us. And then we have to make judgments upon it. But the problem is that the press knows full well that for most Americans couldn't care less except about those few issues which immediately intrude upon their lives and their pocketbook. Otherwise, they simply want news which titillates, news which excites, news to which they can emotionally react. As long as you can show pictures of starving children in Ethiopia, you'll get a reaction, a wonderful kind of reaction, an outpouring of sympathy. But those few magazines and papers which have tried to present material which explores the longer, deeper issues about drought in Africa, the difficult problems of industrialization and the reformation of the agricultural system, the problems of the kind of tribal life which exists there with all of its primitive cultural strengths and weaknesses, and the need to bring agriculture and culture and transportation and the like into a new day. This kind of material is not read. It's tossed aside. And so, as far as the American public is concerned, once the planes have taken the grain and the care agencies have given their care, they will turn themselves, they'll turn their interest to other areas and to other things. And the real issue, the real concerns will not have been met. I'm an unabashed devourer of newspapers, of news media. I find that one of the great advantages of this is that somehow you can play off one person's prejudices against another. But I've been struck increasingly by two things. The first is the increased diminution, the narrowing of the amount of news available in the mass media. On television, as much time is given to sports and to the weather and to road reports and things of this kind as to, quote, the news. The news stories have to be brief and have to be exciting and have to be the surface of things. And if there is a deeper search for the news, it'll be put on at 12 o'clock at night when no one can possibly be thinking clearly, where the audience is the smallest, and the television, when it tries to justify its news coverage, its real justification is economic, but when it tries to justify it in a high moral and public way, it points to the amount of news coverage that it shows after 12 o'clock or on Sunday morning and early afternoon. And most of that coverage, an increasing amount of that coverage, is not the depth research, the reporting of a story, but it's simply three or four reporters pontificating about the issues of the day. That's cheaper. Now many are watching, and here's a way to give an opinion, an op-ed page, if you will, without having to do any original research, any real going out and digging up for the story. Not that these programs aren't interesting, but they don't represent news gathering as such. And I've noticed increasingly in our own paper, such as it is, there's a great deal of fashion, there's a great deal on foods, there's a great deal on the social, there's a great deal on amusements and what's called culture in Cleveland. There's very little news, unless there's a crisis like the recent one in the savings and loans. And then I assure you, you found out more about the basis and the background, what was happening, from the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal than you did from the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And if you look at our paper, what you discover is that a very small percentage of its personnel are devoted to news gathering, are really reporters as such. And to a very large degree, what you have, and increasingly so, are scissors and paste materials, which have been sent over the wires from the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, or columns from this columnist or the other, an op-ed page, the editorial page. The semblance of news, or the discussion of what others have garnered as news rather than new information, new material, material which can be useful to the citizen. Everything that the news does needs to be sold. And so it needs to be exciting. And so that even when the news, the television, for instance, goes out to do a story in depth, It must do it in terms of a confrontation or a conspiracy. The General Westmoreland trial was, I found, fascinating. It was fascinating not so much because of the internal issues having to do with how CBS handled the cutting of this tape or that tape or the other, but because it was clear as you read the background of the trial that CBS had a story, fascinating one, one we all ought to think about. How is it that a government, during a time of crisis, passes on information to its citizens? And what does the propaganda effort devised by a government to encourage its citizens to sympathize with a particular set of attitudes, what does that propaganda effort do ultimately to the prosecution of the war itself? Because what you had at issue here was a series of military and political leaders who got, to a very large degree, trapped into the lies that they were telling us. Now that's an interesting story. But it's not a story which has to do with a conspiracy within the military not to reveal something to the administration. It's not a story which necessarily has one man who is the focus of decision-making and of all evil. It's a story which is important because of what it tells us of the processes of a so-called free society. But that kind of story could not have been done. It lacks a focus. It lacks a conspiracy. And so you needed the straw man, General Westmoreland. And it became an issue of his integrity rather than of the integrity of the whole political system. A far different story, a far less important story than it might otherwise have been. We can't easily live with the media, and we certainly can't live without the media. The word media is an interesting one. It comes from an old Greek word which means, was defined originally an intermediate vocal stop between a very high pitch and a very low pitch. It came to mean the intermediate range of things, the middle level, intermediary, mediation. All these words come out of the same root. Well, the media was as a word coined, taken over by some social theorists at the end of the Second World War because they needed an umbrella term which would within it, radio, television, the theater, movies, newspapers, all those instrumentalities which lift up for us the events, the visions, the ideas, the images of our own day. They stand between us and our world. We need them. We need them desperately. We need for them to do the best possible job that they can do. We recognize that there are certain limitations implicit upon the media because they are part of the capitalist system, if you will. But far better that they be part of a free enterprise system than that they be part of the governmental system and simply be agencies of the government. And so they are caught in their own limitations, and we are, to a large degree, limited by those limitations. But at the same time, they are necessary to us. And none of our criticisms of the media ought really to be allowed to give aid and comfort to those who would turn the media around so that they would respond purely to their ideological perspectives. One concluding word. As you know, many of the nations in the Second and the Third World have been making an effort through UNESCO to see to it that reporters are licensed and that the material which they are allowed to report on within their countries redounds purely to the wholesomeness and the well-being and the developmental capacities, the positive things within that country. They're unhappy with the tendency of Western reporters to go into their country and report on graft and corruption and report on the misuse of funds received from abroad, to report on the abuses of human freedoms and the like. And we share the concerns of our government and the governments of the Western world in opposing this kind of licensing procedure. It would markedly limit our ability to know what's happening in the rest of the world. But all of us are tempted to take that point of view. I was struck recently when the Plain Dealer published a series of articles on Case Western Reserve University. What I heard in Cleveland was not a discussion of the pros and cons, the facticity or falsity of these articles. And one can judge these articles in many ways. But what I heard was, here's the Cleveland Plain Dealer trying to bury the city. Why can't they say something positive about the city? And that's, in a sense, is exactly what the third world is saying about the reporters of the first world. Why can't they say something positive on us? Let's find a way to make them do it. Now, if we believe in a press which is free to go out and garner the information which we need as free citizens to make up our minds on the issues of the day, we need a muckraking press. We need a press which will sometimes be excessive in its muckraking. We need a press which will look under the rocks, not a press which will simply be an echo of whatever the Chamber of Commerce or the Defense Department or General Motors or whoever is concerned with what it wants to get across, not only what it wants to get in the positive and upbeat point of view. And so to a very large degree, the press needs the support and the encouragement of the very people who trust it the least, you and I. And we need to find ways by reading, by study, by encouraging others to have the same kind of sensitive political concerns that we do, to encourage the press, the media, to know that there is a readership, there is an audience for the more serious approach to the news, and that they will have the numbers in their sweeps and the numbers in their circulation figures, which would allow them to do more serious things, to really be the safeguard of the democratic freedoms which we need them to be. Amen.